Today's Taisho will be on case 25 in the Piyen Lu, the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 25 is entitled The Master of Rengeho's Staff. Engo's Introduction. If the action of one's ki is not independent of one's degree of enlightenment, one falls into a sea of poison. If one's words do not astonish the crowd, one slips into the conventional. If you can distinguish black from white, in the moment of a spark's being struck, and can tell life from death in the instant of a flash of lightning, then you will be able to command all quarters and stand firm like a 1,000-foot cliff. Could it ever be so? See the following. Main subject. The master of Engeho's cottage held out his staff and said to his disciples, "When, in olden times, a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there?" No one could answer, and he replied for them, "Because it is of no use in the course of life." And again he asked, "After all, what will you do with it?" And once again he said in their stead, "Taking no notice of others, throwing his staff over his shoulder, he goes straight ahead and journeys deep into the recesses of 100,000 mountains." Secho's verse, his eyes filled with sand, his ears with clay, even among the 1,000 mountains he does not remain. Falling blossoms, flowing streams, he leaves no trace. Open your eyes wide and you'll wonder where he's gone. Thank you so much for sitting so well this morning. We all got up, and we came in here at 5 o'clock in the morning, and we recited the sutras, and then we did three periods of zazen. And everybody made an excellent effort. Thank you so much. Yesterday I talked a little bit about our true nature. In Zen, we talk about something called true nature. People who have been practicing Zen for a while use that word without necessarily understanding what it means. Imagine something like this. Let's say that there is a king or queen who is kidnapped at a birth and taken out of the royal palace and made to work as like a laborer, you know, and gets up very early in the morning and digs trenches all day. And people treat this person rather cruelly. The person grows up fighting for everything he has with his comrades. That person rather predictably would be very aggressive, very fearful of others, very quick to anger, because those are the traits that would have been necessary in that environment for that person. Now you could imagine maybe another person also kidnapped from the castle and taken to a place where basically he's kept in a very pampered situation, right? Given food, given delicious meals, sleeps on a soft bed. You know, neither one of these people would ever maybe wonder who they really were or where they really came from. You know, the first person would grow up in a very violent environment, having to fight for his food. And the second person would have no cares in the world, you know, just get up in the morning and everything would be taken care of for him or for her. And in different ways, both of those people would be trapped by their circumstances. You know, in the first case, the person would become angry and violent. In the second case, the person would become sort of like self-indulgent. You know, every day would be like, what'll I wear today? What'll I eat today? And different environments would produce kind of the same result, which is ignorance of their real history, you know. So, one way to look at our situation is that we're all somewhere between those two cases, right? You know, we've all been kidnapped from our true home. And we've been raised in circumstances that have made us forgetful of who we really are. And, you know, we all are products of our environment. The nature of our environment is that it seems totally complete most of the time. You know, I myself have done... I've worked a lot of hard jobs. I mentioned them earlier. You know, when I got out of high school, I had to work construction. And I had to get to a construction site very early in the morning. And you put in 8 real hours, you know, of very hard work. Your focus contracts down to, you know, just getting through the next hour. And, you know, you become very focused on simple things, not getting injured, you know, not wearing yourself out, working at a pace that's manageable. You know, if you take a break, there used to be on the construction site this big water cooler, big yellow water cooler. I would go over there and just have this glass of ice water. It would be like paradise, you know. And, you know, when I would come home at the end of the day, I wanted to read or I wanted to do something, but I was so wiped out, you know. I was living with some other guys and they would just watch the tube and I would just watch the tube until I passed out, and then the next day, same thing. And I realized it was so easy, you know, it was a good thing I could go back to college, because if you live that life, you know, it's so easy just to work yourself very, very hard and come home and be so wiped out, maybe you have a beer and you pass out in front of the tube. And I had friends like that. You know, I had friends who were professional carpenters, and they all kind of lived like that. They worked really, really hard, and on the weekend, they would watch football games and drink beer. I had two friends, the Swarthout brothers, Swarthout brothers. And they were both carpenters, and I was the laborer on the site. And they invited me over to their house, and it was a bungalow outside of Seattle. And when I came up on the porch, I saw that they had stacked cases of beer up to the top of the fence of the porch, you know. So that was their supply of beer, you know, they would just watch football and drink beer. And on Monday, they'd be back on their jobs, you know. So, you know, it would be easy to criticize them for not having any curiosity, but their lives were so difficult, and their focus got so narrow. You know, I have not had the haven't been in a situation where I didn't have to worry about money and things like that when I was growing up. But I can imagine, I've certainly known people who were very wealthy. I went to college with people who were very wealthy. And, you know, basically their lives were all plotted out for them. You know, I went to a school in Virginia where lots of rich people go. In fact, it's famous for having a lot of very privileged people go there. If they couldn't get into Harvard or Yale, they would go to the school where I went. And they all had, very nice clothes. They all owned cars. And they didn't just own a car, they owned like a fancy British sports car and things like that. And their lives were all plotted out for them. They went to, a lot of them went to elite high schools. And then they were going to go to this college where I went. And then they had their jobs waiting for them, usually with their parents. And, you know, they were trapped too. You know, I used to take courses in philosophy and art, history. And I would, some of these people were my friends, and I'd say, why don't you sign up for a philosophy course? And they'd look at me like I was crazy. It's like, why would you want to do that? Who cares? You know. And I'd say, well, you know, look at this, you know. Life is absurd, you know. And they'd look at me like, I quote some philosopher, and they'd look at me like, come on, get real, right? And their lives were all mapped out for them, right? You know, they had lives of privilege waiting for them. A lot of them were in a fraternity, which I wasn't in. And they would marry girls who were in sororities. And so, you know, their girlfriends also came from the same background. And they would all, get married and inherit their family's business. And there were a lot of people around there. My wife had a summer job where she was working for the U.S. Census. And outside of the town where I went to school, which was called Charlottesville, there were all these big country estates of very wealthy people. And my wife had to go to each of these places and conduct a census for the United States government. So she would have to ask, you know, how many people live in your house? How many of you work? You know, how many children do you have? How many children are under 18? And she said she drove out to one of these places and nobody was in the answered the front door. So she went around the back and everybody was sitting around this big pool. And she said, she showed them her badge. She said, I'm from the United States Census Bureau. And I want to ask you some questions. And they said, you know, sure, sit down. Do you want a drink? And my wife said, I can't do that right now. And then they said, she said, do any of you, do you work? And they all burst into laughter, like, work, you know. So, you know, both of those, you know, my experience is that people in both of those situations are very trapped, you know, in different ways. You know, I definitely liked my carpenter friends more. They were very down-to-earth people, and they had a tough life, you know. And I went to school with some people who were, you know, from this other world. And not they weren't, you know, bad. They were just going along to get along, as we say. You know, they had lives of privilege. And, you know, neither of these people could change their lives very much. You know, neither of these people could become something different. And in a way, they were both trapped by those circumstances. Well, I think we're all a little bit trapped by our circumstances, you know. We're like the children of a king or a, you know, or a queen, whatever, who was kidnapped and taken to this place, and maybe we grew up with the carpenters who drink all weekend and watch football, or maybe we grew up with the rich people who live outside of Charlottesville and spend their day in diversions, right? In amusing diversions, because they have giant 401ks and they live off their 401ks. You know, we're all a little bit like that. And so as a result, you know, none of us, or it's very difficult for people to get to know who they really are, to discover our real ancestry, so to speak, you know. But I do think, you know, that sometimes we remember something, we remember something from our long ago original home. It just happens that sometimes people are going through the life that was given to them, and some, for some reason, they become unhappy in that life. You know, this happens to people, right? I definitely have met people who, grew up in that very privileged way, and who rebelled against it. You know, they decided they didn't want to get married to the sorority girl or marry the fraternity boy, and they rebelled, and they fought their way out. You know, that does happen, and I've definitely known people from the other world too. You know, one of my friends in graduate school grew up in rural Kentucky, and he was a poet. And he has published a number of books. Some of them have won awards. And he grew up in that kind of world, and he said, "I just had to get out of that world." He said, "You know, there's something else besides football on Saturday." And he started reading poetry, and he sort of escaped, right? You know, sometimes something inside of us says, this is not who I really am. This is not what I really am. And I think we have a lot of pressure on us not to make that decision. You know, there's a lot of social pressure to be a certain way. And we put a lot of pressure on ourselves because we do want to please our parents, right? You know, I had a friend in college whose father was one of the most successful lawyers in West Virginia. And his father wanted him to be a lawyer. And I won't tell you his name because the law firm is really one of the biggest firms in the D.C. area. And my friend really tried to fight that, you know. And it caused him a lot of emotional distress. He actually went to Europe for a few years trying to escape from that environment that he grew up in. And he did become a lawyer, but actually he didn't become a lawyer in his dad's firm. He became a public defender. So he defended poor people, the kind of people his dad would never have defended. You know, and his father wasn't an evil man. You know, his father wanted his son to be happy and live the best possible life, which was probably working in his firm. You know, that's what he thought. So it's hard to break out. But sometimes something inside of us says you need to break out. And if you don't listen to that voice, I think you get depressed. You know, depression is actually like a national problem in the United States. And I think the rates of depression are very high because people feel trapped in the lives they don't want to live. I think depression is created by a split between our conscious life and our unconscious life. Between our conscious life and our unconscious life. And I think that the unconscious mind remembers something that the conscious mind has forgotten. You know, the unconscious mind is like the child, the kidnapped child who remembers something about her home, her ancient home. See, I definitely think that's true. So, you know, the conscious mind grows up being a good boy or a good girl. And, you know, maybe at some point the conscious mind becomes unhappy and tries to push it away, and the result is depression. But you know, recovering from depression is a matter of reuniting the two halves of our nature, the conscious life with the unconscious life. See? And because Americans, I think, are so far from their unconscious life, depression is quite widespread in not just America, but in the modern world in general. Everybody's trying to fit in. Everybody's trying to be basically wealthy and powerful. This causes great a sadness and suffering for many people trying to fit in. Sometimes we do real violence to ourselves by trying to meet the expectations of others. You know, so my theory is that depression is caused by the conscious mind is pulling in one way and the unconscious mind is pulling in the other way. But the unconscious mind is wiser than the conscious mind. We people believe in we Chan people, we Zen people believe the unconscious mind is wiser than the conscious mind. We believe the unconscious mind can lead us to health and happiness again if we learn how to have a relationship with that mind. You know, so it's possible to wonder if this is your first sesshin, you know, what are we doing here sitting for 8 hours a day motionless? If somebody walked in here, they'd have no idea what we're doing. They might say we're in a trance. They sit down and they go into a trance. But actually that's not what's happening. We're quieting the conscious mind so we can remember who we are. We can remember our ancient home, see. And most of the many things in our life, not all of them, but many things are not going to help us get back there. You know, we have to sit down on the cushion and watch the breath until we enter wuxin, empty mind. And this is the beginning of reuniting the two halves of ourselves. See, this is the beginning of our returning to, you could say, wholeness, or returning to oneness, right? We have to forget what the conscious mind has learned in order to let the unconscious mind lead us to happiness. So you know, a lot of Zen practice is learning how to watch the breath until the chattering mind, which is the conscious mind, begins to become silent. And this takes many days, especially for beginners, it takes many days. And sometimes when you're trying to do Zen practice, initially you have to fight against many feelings that you bring with you from your conscious life. You know, so, you know, there are actually people who don't come to sesshin because they feel guilty taking time off from work. Now, there are definitely people who can't come to sesshin because they have to work. And I understand that they have to work. But there's also people who don't come here because they feel guilty when they, you know, this isn't time spent on their job. It isn't time spent on their family. It isn't going to help their professional identity. So it's a little frightening to say, I'm not going to do anything that will help any of these. I'm going to go sit down on a mat for 5 days. You know, actually, that's quite terrifying to some people. You know, and so sometimes when people come to sit and do a sesshin for the first time, one of the biggest obstacles they have is a sense of guilt, you know, just for being here. You know, this might feel like unproductive use of your time, you know, and so on and so on. So you know, part of this early process of practicing is just learning how to decondition the mind. You know, maybe you're sitting. You know, there was a guy in our Zen group who's no longer sits with us. But you know, he used to sit, and when we would have our walking meditation, if you've ever done meditation on a Monday or a Friday night at Rutgers, we have a 35 minute meditation followed by walking meditation. And during walking meditation, he would disappear. And he'd be back in the Zendo when we started the next sit. And he would go into the computer room. And I would see, it was like I'd get ready for Kinhin. And this guy would just disappear. He'd sort of peel off and go into the computer room. And one day, I think I let Sandy lead the Kinhin. And I went into the computer room and he's sitting there texting. Right? Really, I'm not making this up. He had to email his friends, he had to know. So he's sitting there in the Zendo thinking, I've got to reply. Who's sending me what, you know? So this is a simple version of what can be very complicated. You know, when we come to Sesshin, we have all of these at any rate, you know what I mean. Obligation. It's my wife always says it. She always gets it right. Coulda, shoulda, woulda, or something like that. But coulda, shoulda, woulda, you know. The coulda, shoulda, wouldas get us, you know. I myself used to feel this way. You know, I used to go to sit. I used to sit once a week, and then I went to a sesshin, and it really transformed my life. And I decided, you know, this is something I really have to do. But, you know, and then I realized if I really want to practice, I need to sit every day. And it was hard for me to sit where I lived because, as I've mentioned, there were two Iranian guys who started watching TV as soon as they got up in the morning right above me. And I couldn't meditate in that. So I began to realize I would sit better if I practiced with others. And we used to have sitting at the Zen Center in the morning at 7 o'clock. And John Sunston, who was a professor at the university, would pick me up in his Volkswagen bus and a couple other people. It was like the Zen bus. And he'd pick us all up and take us down to the Zen house and we'd sit. And as soon as I got to the Zen house, I would sit down on the cushion and I would immediately feel guilty. You know, I'd immediately feel like, what the hell am I doing here? I should be writing my dissertation. You know, I should be in the library. And, you know, I've mentioned that my dissertation director, when he found out I was doing Zen, he was very upset. He said, what are you wasting your life with that for? You know, you're spending a huge amount of time on an unproductive activity. Think of your career. You know, that's really what he said. And I would sit there and I would hear his voice in my ear going, what are you doing? You're throwing away, you know. And then I'd have all this anxiety for a while. And then finally I would just watch the breath and his voice would die out, right? And I'd begin to feel entering deep samadhi, deep ding. And I would feel calm and stable. That was the best feeling of the day, right? I would feel calm and stable. And I would stay in that state for like another hour, you know, two or three sits. And then we would have breakfast and I would go off to school. So it was the reason I got through graduate school, because, you know, I could stabilize myself in this way. But there were definitely friends of mine who were sort of intrigued, but they didn't want to give up that library time. So it's, you know, it's very difficult to resist the pull of our conditioning. And even if we say, that's it, I want to get rid of the pull of my conditioning, it's still there. You know, we still, you're still living out the lessons of your childhood or living out the lessons of your youth and so on. So you know, basically, we need to do an end run around the conscious mind. People need to go into deep wuxin, watch the breath until the mind becomes blank, and then koans are like subjects for meditation that you focus on, and they speak directly to the unconscious mind. See, so koans don't make much sense to the conscious mind, but they're speaking, you could say, directly to the unconscious mind. Sometimes poetry is like that. You know, you read something and you read something and you think that didn't make any sense. And then, you know, a year later you remember those words and somehow they've stuck with you all this time, because they spoke to your unconscious mind. So that's true for this koan also. The master of Rengeho Cottage held out his staff and said to his disciples, when in olden times a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there? So he asked his students, we're all trying to get to enlightenment. In olden times, when a man of enlightenment reached that goal, he didn't remain there. Why? No one could answer. And he says, because it is of no use in the course of life. See, now, that's a very strange thing for a Zen teacher to say. We would expect the Zen teacher to say, you know, Zen will really help you be a better doctor. It will really help you be a better physicist, you know. But he doesn't say that. And you know, if for certain, for his students, maybe that was puzzling. You know, I've told this story before, but I have to, it's so appropriate, right? There was a famous baseball player in Japan named Sadaharu Oh. He was like the Jeter of Japanese baseball, right? And he was a hitter, also, and he began to strike out a lot, and his career really slumped, and it went into such a slump that he entered a Zen temple for a year. He took off. It was like unheard of, right? It would be like Alex Rodriguez or somebody saying, "I'm taking off a year of baseball because I'm in a slump and I'm going to go enter a Zen temple." And Genki Roshi used to talk about this all the time. You know, Sadaharu Oh entered a Zen temple, and then he'd always go on to something else. And finally, somebody said, "Well, when he came out of the temple, how was his game?" And Genki said, "Oh, it didn't get any better." So you can say, well, what a waste of time, right? But you know, actually, whether you're in a slump or not doesn't really matter. You know, that's so small compared to what really matters. You know, who are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? Who are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? You know, Sadaharu Oh had already been a big base. He was already on a lot of baseball cards, you know. After that, you know, and sooner or later, you're going to stop hitting at the same, your batting average is going to get lousy. You know, it's going to happen to everybody. You know, I hope Tiger Woods can come back. It would be thrilling. But, you know, he was the greatest golfer in the world for what? You know, 7 or 8 years, right? You know, if he doesn't come back, it's not the end of the world, right? I mean, most of us don't get to be the greatest anything for 7 or 8 years, right? Yeah, he's had a pretty good run. So maybe it would be more important for Sarahara O to be able to answer those questions. You know, maybe Sadaharu O was playing baseball to please his parents. You know, we don't know. But you know, getting in touch with your true nature is really more important than being the best batter in the Japanese big leagues, I would say. And I think that's what Genki Roshi actually meant, although he never explained it. We all know the story of Anthony Bourdain, right? Somebody, by the way, whose show I loved. I love Anthony Bourdain. I loved him. And you know, he committed suicide, and it's just baffling. Like, why did this guy kill himself? Well, you know, I mean, I can imagine many people in the food industry who would have loved to be Anthony Bourdain, you know, celebrity chef. If you've ever read Kitchen Confidential, it's hilarious. He's a very smart guy. Yeah, and he writes really well. It's just, he had it all. But, you know, he struggled with depression. And depression means that there was a gap between his conscious life and his unconscious life. And, you know, he, in a way, maybe Anthony Bourdain became a prisoner of his success. You know, he had to keep being Tony Bourdain. He had to keep doing this show, you know, and going out to, you know, eat squid legs in Vietnam, you know, and things like that. But you know, maybe that's not, there was some unfulfilled need in him, right? And he was not able to access his true nature. And so, you know, the thing that everybody found astonishing was that this person could be so successful and so unhappy. And he was unhappy. You know, and he masked it very well, but it was because he had not met his true nature. You know, so it's not so important. I mean, I do want to be good at my job. I work really hard to be good at my job. If somebody wants to give me an award someday, I won't turn it down, you know. I'll go and I'll be happy to get the award. But, you know, it's important to put it into perspective. It's not the same thing as meeting your true nature face to face. You know, when you meet your true nature face to face, it can, you know, there might be nothing going on, you know. You might just be watching the rain outside, but you feel totally whole and alive. When the unconscious and the conscious are reunited, it's a little bit like yesterday's koan, right? You come alive, you feel that energy, you feel that freedom and that spontaneity, that trust. This lack of self-trust is a symptom of the split in our nature, right? The split in ourself, you could say, between the unconscious and the conscious. The conscious mind looks at the unconscious and sees a crazy madness. You know, I dare not do that. You know, if I trust my unconscious mind, you know, I'll do something. I'll go to Atlantic City and blow all my money at the crap tables or something like that. But, you know, those fears come from not trusting ourselves, right? People don't go to Atlantic City and lose all their money gambling because their true nature told them to. They do that because they're out of touch with their true nature. People engage in destructive behaviors are not doing it because they trusted their unconscious too much. It's because they didn't trust it enough. And so they develop compulsive behaviors. So, you know, today is day 3 of the Sesshin. This is our chance to really encounter our true nature. You know, often on day 3 of Sesshin, day 2 of Sesshin, people usually reach a point where they feel like they can't go on. And sometimes it's day 3, you know. But usually when people leave Sashin, that guy leaving on day one was kind of unusual. Usually people leave right around last night. You know, they come in to see me in Dokusan, if they see me in Dokusan, and I can see that they have this look on their face like they have to leave. And I'll say, oh, come on, just stay till breakfast. I'll say, stay till lunch. And they'll say, no, no, I've got to go. Stay till breakfast. No, no, I've got to go. Right? You know, just stay till the sutras. No, no. They're gone, right? So, you know, I understand. But, you know, if you stay around day three, you know, something happens. It's like we've erected this wall between ourselves and our unconscious mind. It begins to become open. The wall turns into a door, and sometimes the door opens a little bit. And when that happens, we feel we have less thinking and deep emotional activation. Yeah? Deep emotional activation. And that, it's like a desert, and now the rain is falling on the desert, and everything is coming to life, right? That can be like day three of Sashin. We're so starved for that rain. That rain of the unconscious mind needs to water our conscious life and bring it back, to renew it. And we have been so distrustful that we haven't allowed that event to take place, but here we are on day three, and it can happen. So just keep working with your koan. Cultivate, if you're watching the breath, just keep watching the breath. At the end of your breath, there's a blank space. Please go to that blank space. And if you're practicing mu, please go deeply into mu. If you're working with your koan, all you have to do is empty yourself out and let the big mind, let your unconscious mind do the work. If the action of one's ki is not independent of one's degree of enlightenment, one falls into a sea of poison. Another way to put that is, if your conscious mind is split from your unconscious mind, you fall into a sea of poison. If one's words do not astonish the crowd, one slips into the conventional. So if you're living out other people's scripts, you're not living. If you can distinguish black from white in the moment of a spark's being struck and can tell life from death in the instant of a flash of lightning, then you will be able to command all quarters and stand firm like a 1,000-foot cliff. In other words, if you unify conscious and unconscious minds, you will be fully alive. You'll be immortal. Immortal. If you unify conscious and unconscious minds, you have entered the deathless. And if you have a heart attack right after that, it won't matter. You know, you will feel, if you're 100% alive, it's eternal. And it really, death is only a problem because we are out of touch with our unconscious mind. Main subject. The master of Rangeho Cottage held out his staff and said to his disciples, when in olden times a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there? No one could answer, and he replied, because it is of no use in the course of life. And again he asked, after all, what will you do with it? In other words, really this is about unifying the unconscious and the conscious mind. Your unconscious mind is locked up in a jail, and you have to let it out. And your conscious mind is locked up in a jail too, and you have to let it commune with the unconscious. And once again, okay, so, and he recites a little poem. Taking no notice of others, throwing his staff over his shoulders, he goes straight ahead and journeys deep into the recesses of the 100,000 mountains. So that's a person, that's a unified mind in accord with the way. unconscious and conscious united. Setchel's verse, his eyes filled with sand, his ears with clay, even among the thousand mountains he does not remain. Falling blossoms, flowing streams, he leaves no trace. Open your eyes wide and you'll wonder where he's gone.